From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline in Washington, filling in this week for your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Just days after the tense and combative confirmation hearings played out here on Capitol Hill, Senator Susan Collins of Maine becoming the first Republican senator to announce their support for Judge Jackson.
By most accounts, the nominee President Joe Biden sent to the Judiciary Committee last month did well in her confirmation hearings. Under often grueling and occasionally offensive questioning, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson kept her cool, displaying the kind of judicial temperament that the committee and all Americans are looking for. Still, today's overheated partisan environment brings new challenges and new revelations for careful court watchers like Attorney Jay Michelson. He'll be with us with his analysis.
Happy trails to you. Till we meet again.
My favorite song. Interfaith Alliance has done a lot of good work over these past decades, and almost all that work has the fingerprints of Director of Outreach and Operations Jay Keller on it, in one way or another. For almost 15 years, Jay kept the big and small wheels of technology, communication, and coordination turning, including much of what it takes to keep State of Belief on the air and online. All the while, he took the lead on a number of major projects, most notably the invaluable LEAD program. As Jay moves into well-deserved retirement, we'll share some memories and some anecdotes on this week's State of Belief Radio.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, government, and smoke and mirrors, and more smoke. With Texas currently ground zero for unprecedented government efforts to erase transgender identity, dignity, and rights, often in the name of God, activists in the state are rallying at the state capitol in Austin April 2nd in connection with Trans Day of Visibility, which was observed March 31st. A broad coalition of advocates and allies, including many faith voices, are taking part in the event spearheaded by the All In for Equality Coalition to confront the governor and attorney general's all-out assault on trans lives, in particular young trans lives. I hate having to talk about the hilariously named Family Research Council all the time, but the endless fundraising pitches just keep coming, and the way the sacred value of religious freedom keeps getting stretched to the breaking point to cover any and all far-right culture war dreams takes one's breath away. The latest? Anthony Perkins is calling for all good Christians to send him money so he can fight the Biden administration's continuing efforts to fight the COVID pandemic. Huh. That's front and center on this hate group's agenda. What else? Outrage that anyone might think a Supreme Court justice whose wife has been secretly flirting with QAnon conspiracists might want to recuse himself from cases involving attempts to overthrow our government in the name of Q. And T, of course. Oh, Anthony, are you high? Speaking of which, sacramental use of marijuana is as old as faith itself, according to the book God on High, Religion, Cannabis, and the Quest for Legitimacy. But Religion News Service reports that a Los Angeles pastor, Craig Gross, is launching a formal business campaign to promote pot as a modern pathway to the divine. His new brand? Christian Cannabis, of course.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. Dr. Jay Michelson is a rabbi, a meditation teacher, an author, and an attorney who writes incisively about the Supreme Court for New York Magazine. With the Jackson confirmation hearings now behind us and the vote due in the next week or so, I'm happy to welcome Jay back to State of Belief Radio. Thank you for being with us again, Jay.
Pleasure to be here.
Jay, what were your thoughts when you heard that Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson was President Biden's pick for the high court?
I was mostly delighted. I think I had a little bit of trepidation about what the confirmation hearings would be like, and certainly the actual hearings bore that out. But Judge Jackson has obviously a very distinguished record, and also I think bringing the background of a public defender to the Supreme Court is something that's really been missing One of the more troubling developments of the last 20 years has been a shift away from defendants' rights and kind of a lot of deference given to prosecutors, and hopefully future Justice Jackson will correct that. So I was really, really delighted, and obviously her nomination and soon-to-be confirmation is historic.
You know, a lot of people are saying that the Supreme Court, as well as the nomination process, has been politicized in ways we haven't ever seen before. Is that true? And if so, how is that playing out this time around?
It's absolutely true. One thing to remember is that this confirmation process with the hearings and so forth is itself somewhat recent. This actually came to light just in these hearings, kind of became a little better known, that it used to be really the Senate would just vote up or down. There wouldn't be public hearings in this way. It was actually Justice Brandeis who was the first nominee who faced this kind of process. Probably not a coincidence. There was a lot of kind of covert and overt anti-Semitism around that process, just as there was covert and overt racism in this process. But this really was, you know, I think Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation was so unusual because of the circumstances around it that stands maybe as the most unusual. But in terms of the treatment of the nominee and the contempt shown by some senators on the Republican side of the aisle for this nominee is unprecedented. We've seen very conservative candidates be grilled on the merits, but not interrupted as many times as we saw, and not talked over and not turned into a kind of poster child for something that they're not. In this case, a sort of fever dream imagination of critical race theory. You know, it's really hard to imagine that Judge Jackson's race and gender had nothing to do with the appallingly disrespectful treatment that she received from several senators.
And how do you think she handled herself during that treatment?
Well, you know, I read just a number of takes online of Black women talking about how they've, you know, dealt in, you know, with very similar situations with very entitled white men kind of treating them disrespectfully and cutting them off. And just, it was like a textbook example. And there was a real irony, actually, right? It was these same senators who were complaining that, you know, white privilege doesn't exist and critical race theory is terrible. And yet they were demonstrating a certain level of privilege and entitlement in their own behavior that proved the truth of all of that discourse, right? I mean, they were exhibit A in how, you know, consciously or unconsciously, all of us act from our positions and from our backgrounds. And if we're not careful about that, if we're not conscious about it, the prejudices of our society, of our white supremacist society, will come out. And that definitely happened. You know, I think she conducted herself with dignity. There's been some good writing about a couple of, you know, pauses that she took. As you mentioned, you know, I have this unusual background where I write about politics, but I also teach meditation. So I'm always attuned to kind of watching how people are reacting and watching their body language and just getting a sense. And, you know, this was somebody who, in my take, this is pure speculation. You know, this is somebody who knew that she had to get through a few days of unpleasantness and then she'd have a lifetime on the court to get it back. Really, honestly, I felt that Justice Barrett was the same way. I mean, she just sat there and grit her teeth through the process, and she knew that she would have, you know, decades to get the last word.
I will say that as a layman in this arena, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't have much experience as a court watcher. The moment that impressed me the most was her stare down of Senator Cruz after his outrageous question. And the like. But how about the answers that she gave to the substantive questions that she was asked? How did she do with the answers to those?
You know, I think she acquitted herself quite well. I don't think there was any doubt if you look at her record, just as from some of the conservative nominees, certainly Justice Gorsuch and Barrett, that, you know, she has what I would call kind of mainstream liberal jurisprudential views. That's enriched by her experience, by her life experience. But I think when it came to the substance of the questions she was asked, you know, she did very well. It shouldn't really be a surprise. I'm sure we'll get into in just a moment some of the surprising questions that were asked and some of the surprising positions that were taken by some Republican senators. I didn't see any surprises, I don't think, in Justice Jackson's or in Judge Jackson's for now answers to those questions. I don't think even on the even most of her critics, I would say, on the right, didn't really take issue with her knowledge of the law. And so I think it was and she knew, of course, that, you know, she most likely had the votes. So she played it safe. She played it conservative, just like nominees do. You know, these confirmation hearings are now a kind of ritual theater. And it's known what you can't say because people have said it in the past and gotten into trouble. And so I think on the substantive questions, Judge Jackson did what she needed to do.
One of the things that seemed to surprise a lot of people, myself included, is that there was not a sort of extended laudatory praise of her that typified some of the other hearings. What do you make of that?
Well, again, you know, this is I like to, rather than offer a kind of a take on it, it just I think the question speaks volumes, right? Why is it that this extremely qualified black woman wasn't treated with the same kind of respect as the parade of white men and one white woman in recent memory? You know, we just let that question sit there. And I think the answer, or at least the plausible answer, announces itself.
So of the questions that were indeed asked, what were one or two that were most surprising to you?
Well, on the surprise side, you know, you'd think having been in this business for, you know, 20 years or so, I would no longer be surprised by the ability of politicians, I would say more on one side than the other, but to invent reality that doesn't exist. And so this entire kind of QAnon focused line of inquiry that Judge Jackson was in some way lenient with child sex offenders and with child pornography. I mean, there's not a shred of evidence. You know, Senator Hawley in particular focused on one particular case when she had seen many cases. And in fact, statistically over the range of cases, her sentencing was right in the middle. It was certainly not on the lenient side when it came to these horrible crimes. You know, I think she did decline to really take a position on her own sentencing and ruling in that one case that Senator Hawley was continually pressing her on. I think it was a lose-lose for her, and she's just not willing to step into a trap where, you know, if she regrets a decision or says, you know, maybe that deserved another look, she doesn't look good there. But if she defends this decision the way that he's depicted it, that's also a loser. So I think the smart decision was not to play, and that's exactly what she did. Certainly that line of questioning was surprising. And then I guess, you know, on the other second line that was surprising to me was how serious these senators were about not just eroding abortion rights, but eroding same-sex marriage, even the right to contraception, and even interracial marriage under the Constitution. You know, that is true. I mean, I was thrown back to law school. I remember learning some of the doctrines that underlie this whole line of cases. And it is true that when you start pulling on one of them, like Roe versus Wade, the others start to look, you know, less secure than they were. It was just a little unnerving to see that actually happen in a Senate confirmation hearing.
From Interfaith Alliance's point of view, the most startling question came from Senator Graham when he asked her to quantify her faith on a scale of 1 to 10. Is that something you've ever heard even hinted at in previous hearings?
No, I mean, if you compare that to, you know, Senator Feinstein's now notorious line that, you know, the gospel lives loudly in you at Judge Barrett's confirmation hearings to be a federal judge. That's just a description, right? I mean, and Judge Barrett had written quite eloquently about her faith. You give someone a quiz. I mean, Jack, what's your number? What's your faith number?
I don't think I could pass a test like that.
I have no freaking idea what my faith number is. I'm a rabbi. Does that mean I get a plus? Do I get to be a 9 instead of an 8? And first of all, I'd be pretty scared of any 10s, right? I am 100%. You know, that's not the life of the spirit, I think, as we understand it, certainly. And just the idea, I mean, that, you know, I almost, I almost tried to not even dignify a lot of what Lindsey Graham has to say, but this was truly unbelievable. And it's beyond offensive. It reminded me a lot of the attempt to describe Barack Obama as a Muslim, you know, and to make him defend his faith. Once again, I can't quite put my finger on what President Obama and Judge Jackson have in common, but maybe if I think about it longer. And it's just, it was close to a religious test for office, which of course, you know, is unconstitutional, but not in a real sense, but just in the idea that that is somehow a relevant question and one that can be answered. That's why I've asked you, maybe we should all start putting our faith numbers on Twitter and we can compare and whoever has the highest one wins.
Along with our pronouns and the
like. That's right. I use he, him pronouns and I have a faith number of 6.
So we've been making a little bit of fun of some of these outlandish questions, but do you think there's sort of a strategy in play here to paint the nominee as partisan now so that a demand on her to recuse herself from some of the upcoming cases, particularly culture war cases, is more likely in the future?
I'm a little skeptical on that one. I think this was much more conventional. I think this was pandering to the base. The Republican side, you know, there was maybe a question as to whether Joe Manchin would vote or not vote for the nominee, but there was never really a doubt. I don't think a serious doubt that this was going to happen. So honestly, just like the Democrats did, particularly with Justice Barrett, you know, when you know that the conclusion is foreordained, you make the best of that situation. So, you know, we were treated again in these hearings to Senator Whitehouse talking about some of the dark money that's behind some of these right wing nominees. That's something that I've written on a lot. And I was really gratified to see it get some airtime during Justice Barrett's hearings. And here, you know, now the shoe is on the other foot. The votes are in the other direction, at least this year. And so I think it was just scoring points at home. I don't think, you know, that we could talk about Justice Thomas's lack of recusal in cases in which his wife is actually directly involved. You know, and even there, there's very little that can be done to compel a justice to recuse. It's not, as listeners might know, justices are not subject to the same ethics rules as federal judges. The only real remedy for an ethical breach is impeachment, which has only happened once in history, and which I don't, even in Justice Thomas's case, I don't really see as appropriate. So I think there is an attempt to paint her as partisan and an ideologue, in part to just legitimize the partisan ideologues on the other side of the court, but mostly, you know, it's a midterm election year. Folks are up for a re-election, and this was a great opportunity to throw red meat to two of the overlapping hard right bases in the Republican Party, the sort of the hardcore religious right and QAnon conspiracy believers.
Were there any missed opportunities in this questioning that you noticed?
That's a really interesting question. I think, you know, we in the media tend to focus on the adversarial questions. And that was true in the Barrett, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch hearings as well. I think the Democrats gave Judge Jackson many opportunities to kind of, you know, be who she is. You're a very accomplished and dignified jurist. So I feel like there was an opportunity from those questions to kind of build out who she really is. But again, that's, you know, no one reads that story. So it's gotten less attention. In a different world, it would be nice if these hearings actually were able to really penetrate into some kind of substantive discussion. But really, that hasn't happened for, you know, 15 years now. And nominees are coached to not take a position on controversial cases. And that's what they do.
Do you think that there's any chance for the confirmation not to succeed? Are there any mechanisms the Senate Republicans might activate to try to prevent her from ascending to the bench?
No.
Well, that's a good and definitive answer.
Sometimes a short answer is the best. Yeah. And I think, especially with us, with Senator Susan Collins now saying she'll vote for her, it's not even purely partisan lines. And look, the Republicans made this bed. Now they get to sleep in it, right? Yeah. There's no filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. I still have engraved in my memory Mitch McConnell's smiling face when he was able to do away with that for his justices. And now we have it on the other side. It obviously does long-term bode ill for the Supreme Court because it encourages the majority party to put out more, I would say, extreme nominees. And some, I think there is some basis for saying that about Judge Jackson. Certainly there were other nominees who were considered who had more centrist or moderate records. I don't think that makes Judge Jackson an ideologue by any extent, but she's not the most moderate candidate who was considered. There were others who were a bit more centrist. And I'm sure we'll see the same the next vacancy, whether it's filled by a Democrat or Republican president. It'll be interesting if the next vacancy is filled by President Biden in a Republican Senate, what happens. But I think the answer is obvious that the Senate majority simply won't consider it.
Well, presuming you're right and nothing will prevent her confirmation, what happens next on the court with her sitting there?
Nothing much happens. I think after this dust clears, maybe the historic nature of her confirmation becomes more central. I think there's good reason to believe that she'll be another voice for the voiceless at the Supreme Court, but in dissent. Obviously, she's taking the place of Justice Breyer, who was votes with the liberals. Justice Breyer is a bit more conservative jurisprudentially than Judge Jackson, based on her current record. So there may be some shift to the left on some cases, but ultimately this is still 6-3, again, pending Justice Thomas's health and whether he's going to stay on the court. But right now, this is still a conservative supermajority. And I think, obviously, Judge Jackson knows that she's signing up for many years of being in the minority as the court lurches to the right on numerous issues.
So you mentioned 6-3, and that raises the question of whether packing the court will become an issue again in the immediate future. What's your perspective on that, and whether, if it came to pass, it would help or complicate things?
So in general, I'm not in my work. I've not been one to kind of criticize President Biden for, missing opportunities. But in this case, I do feel that we've missed an opportunity. Maybe the window isn't shut. My most optimistic view on this question is, it means it gets worse before it gets better. But if we assume that Roe versus Wade is significantly overturned, if not entirely overturned, in June, that will wake up a lot of people who do not listen to this podcast, to this radio show, and who are not necessarily plugged in. Hopefully, it'll be good for places like Interfaith Alliance. Like this should be a big wake up call for folks who are not, I don't want to criticize them for not paying attention. There's a lot to pay attention to, but who are not as plugged in. There may at that point be momentum for changes in the court structure. I've gone on record as supporting term limits rather than changing the court size, but term limits that would come into effect more or less immediately. And so that would, that would take a couple of the more conservative senior justices off the court over a period of years. I think the Biden commission really missed the opportunity to actually have a clear recommendation that we could all get behind and make it a serious issue and not just sort of say, yes, we should think about it and other people will hopefully decide, which is what I think they basically said. So I'm optimistic that there will be some momentum for some kind of reform, whether it's enlarging the court. I choose not to use the term court packing. That's the other side's term. but whether it's enlarging the size of the court, which is hardly set in stone and is certainly not set in the Constitution, or whether it's figuring out some way that there could be some kind of term limits. The stakes are just much too high if you think about it. This is why I tend to favor term limits. It's random when justices step down, so it's totally unpredictable. They either pass away or they retire, but it's like we're playing Russian roulette with democracy. And then the stakes are so high because you're putting someone on a court potentially for 30 or even 40 years, right? Depending on, life expectancy. And, and so we get these younger and younger justice candidates who spend decades on the court and will have an impact practically into the next century. And, those stakes are much too high for this kind of randomized process. It's not, in a different period in our country's history, when the Senate wasn't quite so undemocratic, right, when states weren't so different in size, and when it was a bit of a kind of an old boys club, which obviously we don't want to go back to, but that, then, you know, this could have been a little less contentious. But now this is a recipe for disaster every time it happens, and we never know when a vacancy is even going to happen. So I'm hopeful, but also not necessarily optimistic.
I wonder if rotating justices off the court would further politicize the process.
Well, the notion is that you would at least know what you're getting into, that this is a 10 or a 20 year period. And it would also have some regularity, right? So if it were term limits, as opposed to increasing the size of the court, you could fix those term limits to particular years. So you would know, you could fix the rotation to be non-election years, for example. And this gone would be this idea that, like, well, now we can't do it because there's an election. And there would be some regularity when the next election for senator, you know, Senate takes place. That would be one of the items that people could campaign on. Well, next year there's going to be a Supreme Court vacancy and vote for me for this or that reason. You know, if you look at where the American public is on issues of some of the issues before the Supreme Court, whether it's, access to voting, or whether it's bodily autonomy, right to abortion, you know, right to same-sex marriage, they're far to the left of center, as the center is somehow defined. I mean, really, the center should be the center, but as the way it's been defined. But that doesn't really get a voice. I mean, it's this kind of random process where every few years we suddenly get excited about mm-hmm. something. And that's, I don't think that that's good for democracy or for the court.
Jay, I want to come back for just a minute to something you mentioned earlier, and that is Justice Thomas and his wife, Virginia Thomas. Has there ever been a similar question about spousal influence on a Supreme Court justice?
Not that I'm aware of. And, you know, we want to like disaggregate a little bit too, what we're talking about, even in terms of influence, right? So there's influence. There's also just an obvious conflict of interest, right? So when Justice Thomas was the sole dissenter recently in a case about the January 6th commission, his wife had something at stake, right? Had a stake in that matter. I mean, that was an obvious, I don't know, a single, you know, mainstream legal scholar who thinks that he shouldn't have recused from that, knowing what he knew, right? He knew that his wife did have a whole long list of incriminating texts, was in touch with some of the witnesses who were being called by the committee, and you know, at the very least would face possible embarrassment, but possibly more, possible criminal liability. I mean, we don't know the extent of what she might face, but he might. And that's obviously a case for recusal. So this isn't even just a case of, well, you know, Ginny Thomas has been a right-wing activist for many years. You know, she's a different person and maybe she influences him, but this is a case of clear conflict of interest. I mean, I can't think of any, you know, imagine you just were at a local criminal court and it was your own kid who stole the candy bar from the newsstand. Of course you would recuse yourself from that case. So it's just open and shut. And, you know, but the level of disregard for judicial ethics is truly, as far as I know, on the Supreme Court level, unprecedented.
You know, our penchant for politicizing every news story that comes our way in every event impels me to ask you the question, will this discussion about Justice Thomas spill over into other decisions and the influences and presence of others in the lives of the other justices have, both looking forward and looking backward at their decisions?
You know, I think because of the distinction that I drew a minute ago, I don't think it has to go that way. I mean, I think if some want to say that he shouldn't be involved in any case in which Ginny Thomas did any advocacy, that would be one thing. And, you know, that she's not just an advocate, of course. I mean, she's at the center of a kind of a network of dark money funded organizations that are very active in picking judges and justices, as well as in advocating for issues. But even so, even with all of that, that's still less than she has a direct personal interest in a matter before the court.
True.
And I think we can address that without getting into the thornier issue of that you alluded to.
So we've highlighted on the show and in Interfaith Alliance some of the cases that affect religious freedom that are coming up in this session and in the docket of the court going forward. Is there a sleeper case you want us to pay attention to? Is there something we should be aware of that our listeners should keep in mind for the good of the country and the good of the court?
That's a great question. It's funny, you know, with this term having such non-sleeper cases, you know, the end, possible end of at least half the gun control laws in the country. Obviously, the rolling back of the right to choose. Even I've forgotten the sleeper cases. I think one thing that listeners to State of Belief know, because Welt and I have talked about it so many times, is the shadow docket and how the court has, particularly on religious freedom issues, used the shadow docket to move far, 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 far to the right. So a lot of these were pandemic cases where there were clearly neutral laws that were also applied in cases of houses of worship, just as in commercial establishments. And Justice Gorsuch particularly, but there was eventually a majority of justices took the view that not only were facially neutral laws invalid, but that really religious institutions should have what's sometimes called in legal parlance most favored nation status. Like they should be have a right to trump any other rights claim. If you think about it for a moment, pandemic cases, this should be a pretty clear one, right? Because this is about saving lives, right? And we're not talking now in the case of Omicron with large number of vaccinated. We're talking first few months and year of the pandemic when people's lives on a large scale were really at stake. And yet the argument that eventually prevailed at the court was that, no, actually a religious organization's right to worship as they choose, which meant come together in unlimited numbers without masks, that was a more favored right, a more important right than the right to save lives, and the government's responsibility to do that. That doctrine may creep into some of the school funding cases that are coming along now. I wrote an article on one of them, I think it was in New York Magazine. And without getting into the weeds of exactly what the funding question is, it's a little bit about this question, like whether religious organizations have a higher level of right than anything else, and religious individuals as well. So if you plug that into the contentious cases of, you know, the florist turning away the gay couple, that would mean that the religious freedom claim isn't even on the same level, which is problematic for various reasons, but actually would get higher level consideration. That's something that is not in the headlines much that listeners of State of Belief might want to pay attention to and watch those school funding cases for broader rules that may actually apply in places we wouldn't expect.
Rabbi Dr. Jay Michelson is a columnist for New York Magazine and a meditation teacher and podcast host at 10% Happier. He's written about the Supreme Court for the last 8 years, first for The Daily Beast and now for New York Magazine, and before that worked as a religious LGBTQ activist for 10 years. Jay is the author of numerous books, most recently Enlightenment by Trial and Error. Jay, as always, it is great to have you on this show, and I thank you for sharing your insights with us on State of Belief Radio. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Jack.
Up next, an on-air exit interview with longtime Interfaith Alliance Director of Outreach and Operations, Jay Keller, who retired on Thursday after 15 years with the organization. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all at stateofbelief.com. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. What's coming next really is two guys telling war stories as they retire. I'm in my last weeks as president of Interfaith Alliance before my own retirement, and Director of Outreach and Operations Jay Keller has failed to reach his 15th anniversary here by just days, wrapping up his tenure last Thursday. While nobody claims that life at Interfaith Alliance is as hilarious as the office, neither is it the sterile policy shop that one might imagine. Despite the fact that issues of religious freedom regularly take on a seriousness up to and including matters of life and death. And so to pull back the curtain on both the highs and lows of life at the Alliance, and to celebrate a truly devoted participant in both, who also happens to be one of the nicest human beings you'll ever meet, I'm happy to welcome Jay Keller to State of Belief Radio. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Jack. It's good to be with you.
Well, it is good to have you here, even if there's a bittersweet quality to all of this. So listen, it's funny that we're together face-to-face in the studio today after the past couple of years where COVID kept us isolated in our home offices. I think we've probably seen each other four or five times since 2 years ago, March 19th. You're such a people person. How did these restrictions and isolations have an impact on you?
Well, it's been interesting to adapt to this Zoom world that we've lived in. And luckily, I've got a very good family life. I have a son who lives close by, another son who lives in California, and my wife. And so we've been managing to get out and walk around and see things and see people in person, if masked, over the last few years. So that's been a good thing. And I do miss the ability to do some travel with Interfaith Alliance that we've done in the past and to see people face to face. It's we joked when we got together for our last staff gathering and people looked taller than we thought they would or just different. And it was kind of an interesting realization to see people not on a 13 or 15 inch screen and see them in person.
I certainly looked wider than I did when you saw me.
As we did all. We did. Yeah.
So, listen, I know that that 15 years ago was a different time in your life, and things were very different when you came to Interfaith Alliance also. Can you talk about what drew you to Interfaith Alliance all those years ago and why?
Sure, sure. Well, I started out working on government change with Common Cause before years ago, and my wife was actually born in Pakistan, and when we got married, we took a year off and traveled, and we went to such fabulous vacation resorts as the Congo and to Pakistan and to India and to Nepal. And my wife, having grown up in a predominantly Muslim country, was my first exposure to really Muslims and to Hindus in India and other diverse faiths that are over there. And it fascinated me. I think the more you get involved in interfaith work, the more you see how much we have in common. And I think that thread of looking for ways to bring people together was something that really attracted me to Interfaith Alliance. And I had a good friend who had done some consulting with Interfaith Alliance who said, oh, it's a great group of people. They do great work. And so that really led me to kind of look at it more closely.
So, you know, I'm not allowed to ask a question like this of people who are coming into a job. But since today's your last day, I can. I don't want to sound too much like Lindsey Graham, but tell me about your own faith.
Sure, sure. Well, I was raised in a Presbyterian family, was in youth fellowship, was in the choir. My parents taught, my dad taught youth classes. My mom was very involved. It was a church that my parents were involved in, my grandparents, my great-grandparents were involved in. And I just love that tradition. But the older I got, the more I think I saw the spiritual side of things in many other different faiths. And it's led much more to an appreciation of those faiths, but also an appreciation for different ways to kind of follow my spiritual path. And we've got very close friends across the street. And every Sunday, we go with them and another neighbor with their dog, and we go hiking through Rock Creek Park or other parks around the area. And we call ourselves, it's the Church of the Sunday Hike. And it's a way to connect with nature and with our sense of a higher being, a higher spiritual being. And so I'm not a regular church goer, but I have a deep appreciation for those who do go. And I think there are many different ways to kind of follow your own spiritual path.
I'm glad you got an opportunity to articulate that for us. So you came to us from an organization that did primarily government relations and into the religious freedom area. What did you want to achieve or feel that you were about to do when you joined Interfaith Alliance all those years ago?
Well, I thought the story of Interfaith Alliance, I mean, when I came on board, really, we had kind of had a motto of that faith should never be used as a weapon. It should be something that has a healing force to it. And that's something that attracts me very much because I see the very positive power of faith, but I've also seen how it's been abused and misused over the years. And I think that attraction to our first discussions when I first met you, Jack interviewed me before I had the job when he was chair of the board, was, I just thought, a very positive way to look at faith and look at different beliefs out there. So I think that drew me to the organization and made me think, yeah, this is a way to really bring people together on a positive note. As you said, I'm kind of more of an optimist on life, and so I'm constantly looking for things like that.
So as you look at the line that you draw from the time you began until now, what kind of progress do you think we've made under your influence and others?
Definitely under others. Well, I think when I joined, it was a time when way back in 2007, there were a lot of people that were talking about the religious right is dead. We don't have to worry about these issues anymore. And I think there was a great diversification of the efforts to work on some of our issues. And I think we still managed to rally and rebuild when we kind of shrunk a little bit over the years. To become, I think, a much, much stronger organization today, kind of lean and mean, or not so mean, but lean and good-natured on stuff. but we've pulled people together. I mean, the passage of the hate crimes legislation was a tremendous victory that's a partial victory. I mean, it's stuff that you have to continue to work on. I worked on campaign finance reform for 5 years, and you kind of felt like, oh, this is never going to get accomplished. So I think the work that we're in is very much a long-term work. It's stuff that has to be ongoing. It's like education. You don't educate people and stop. You keep on going with this.
My guess is you came in with some expectations of the things you would be doing. And my guess is there were things you never thought you would be doing. What are the preconceived ideas that you had that were reinforced over the years? And tell me at least one thing that surprised you.
Yeah. Well, when I came in, I was hired as the director of kind of grassroots operations. And that's something I've always enjoyed and appreciated, of working with grassroots activists all across the country. And that's something that I just enjoy. I enjoy people. I enjoy the diversity of opinions that I get exposed to. The stuff that was a little bit more surprising may have been more of the operations side of things. I became the IT point person in the organization that was mostly PCs, and I'm a Mac user, and so I had to learn some of those things. And I've had to learn terminology and technology that I had no idea I had any skills, and still I'm not quite sure I have lots of skills in those areas, so I'm happy to pass them on to others who do. I think what didn't surprise me is just finding out how many good people there are out there that we get a chance to work with.
Wonderful. Wonderful. We mentioned a program called LEAD at the top of the discussion, and that's LEADD. I know that was one of the signature programs that you took a great deal of pride in. Can you talk about LEAD a little bit?
Sure. LEAD was a great program that the Davidoffs kind of came up with, because at a time, you know, civics education in the United States is just not something we do much focusing on. And so they really came up with the idea of doing a civics program. Originally, we did it as a week-long kind of summer camp with high school students to bring them in to educate them about civics in America and the role of religion in America, both from the founders all the way through today. So we brought usually anywhere from 20 to 30 kids together for first a week, and then it became a weekend program. As diverse as we could find it. When we did the Oklahoma program, I think we had 22 kids from 16 different faith traditions. You know, Jewish kids that had never met a Muslim before, Hindus that had never met a Christian. It was just very, very diverse and a great group. And as I said, we did kind of a night of kind of introduction, and people were allowed to ask any questions they wanted to about, you know, other faith traditions. You know, Catholics, aren't you kind of cannibalistic? You do the blood of Christ and you think it transforms into blood. And Catholics kind of going, wow, you're right. We hadn't thought of it in those terms. Or kids saying, Muslims, how do you survive a month of not eating or drinking? It's like then you had to explain Ramadan. So it was a great experience. And what was amazing is at the end of every one of the camps that we did, kids came away saying, we've got so much more in common than we have in difference. And that was a very powerful thing. I think we had about 250 kids who went through the program over the years from 2005 to 2012. It was just a great program. And we learned a lot about how to talk about these issues.
So, you know, it's funny, Jay, you've been the epitome of discretion during all of our years together. I've never heard you say a negative word about anybody, at least nothing I would acknowledge publicly. And as long as you're director of outreach and operations, which is, as we're taping this, just another few hours, you would maintain that. But tomorrow you'll be officially retired, and then this program will air after that. So how about some piece of insider gossip or secrets that we can let loose?
Yeah, I don't really have any great juicy pieces of gossip that I can tell about things. I mean, it's mostly, you know, funny stories about you know, things that we did and had to do over the years and scrambling when we had to make up for little glitches in the system. We had one weekend I came in and we got into the office and the entire server had just kind of died and we were scrambling to get a new server. But there are things that... As I said, it was just a great trip all along the way. Not with some ups and downs. I was in the office for 15 years, and I think I moved 8 times into different offices. So we had a little bit of a sliding around transition from place to place.
And Moving Man was one of your one of your other talents.
Yes, yes. Isa Tuhide, our director of finance and HR, and Ariel Gingell, who was our old director of policy. One weekend, we put everything in a moving van, and we moved it to our new place, which was over in the World Wildlife Federation building, which is now was taken over by President Obama. That's his new office.
There you go. Talk about some of the folks other than me that you've had a chance to work with during your time.
Hey, Jack, I'm sorry to interrupt. This is the producer, but we have an urgent telephone call for Jay that we have to take right now.
Hello?
Hello?
Hey.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good.
How is this day for you?
Oh, it's a little bit surreal. It's interesting after almost 15 years to be signing off.
Well, I'll tell you what. I am so glad that I can get to speak to you this morning. I have been thinking about you all this week and also wanted to... speak about you today. You know, Jay, from day one, when you became a part of Interfaith Alliance, I never really thought of you about having a job with us as much as seeing you work with a commitment that had been most of your life. You believed in what Interfaith Alliance was doing, and across the years, I think you touched responsibly and contributed helpfully to every single part of what has happened in Interfaith Alliance. I can't think of anything you didn't do, and I know that Jack, as well as me, is grateful for the diversity of ways in which you made us a better and stronger organization. You worked more out of devotion to the values of Interfaith Alliance than what was on your job description. I could not count the number of times that I was somewhere in the United States calling you on the phone to give me a direction that I needed to carry out my responsibility. The truth is that you taught me much more than I ever learned. And that is why I still often call you today when I need your guidance. And I'm not going to quit calling you just because you're in retirement.
That sounds good, Weldon. I often thought that my job description, the other duties as assigned, was the much larger portion of my job, but it's always made life interesting and enjoyable.
Well, I hope today is a good day, and I'll look forward to us having a conversation in the future about what's going on with you and with me and what I'm needing.
I count on that, Walt, and I look forward to continuing our friendship and wish you well, and wish you and Judy both well.
Thank you. Listen, have a good day.
Caller, before you go, can I ask one question?
Sure.
Who is this?
Who is this?
Is, of course, Reverend Welton Gaddy, my predecessor and the usual host of State of Belief Radio.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Welton.
Okay, thank you.
Where were we? Who are some of the unforgettable friends and allies you've met?
Oh, boy, there's so many. I think of so many of the different affiliate leaders, from Connie Ryan to the two Carls, one in Wyoming and one in Pennsylvania, to Judy Cross in Idaho. Just, you know, really legendary people that were very inspiring to me. I had a chance to travel once with Bishop Jane Holmes Dixon, of beloved memory, who was a member of the staff and just a cherished member of the interfaith community. We went out to Iowa for a swing, and she spoke at one of their annual dinners. And just the funniest person. I mean, you meet a bishop, and you kind of expect them to be very staid. And Bishop Jane was just one of the funniest people I've ever met, and just a great person.
I remember going on a road trip with her, and she picked me up in her pickup truck, and all the way there told me the hilarious story of how she and Diane Rehm went to a dealership to buy that truck and had to persuade the salesperson that it was for them and not for one of their husbands.
Yep.
Anybody else you can think of?
Well, I've had great conversations with Welton over the years. Sometimes for IT support, he'll call me on things. He called me one day with a conundrum. He couldn't get his scanner to work, and I finally got him to use his camera to show us how it was plugged in, and he had plugged it into the Ethernet port of his computer. I was mystified of how he was able to even do that. But great people all along. We did a great road trip up for the 10th anniversary of the Pennsylvania affiliate. So it's just, you know, it's just great people all along. All the lead faculty, Glenn and Sipra Johnson, have just been longtime supporters of the organization and of the lead program over the years, and were faculty members. And just, you know, people that gave their time and their efforts to the organization out of just a commitment to this idea of protecting those boundaries between religion and government.
So we have a lot of folks who do not believe that it's possible for people from different faith perspectives to get on the same track on anything. Do you have any secrets about how you've succeeded in getting folks from so many different backgrounds, from so many different locations, from so many different ideologies, to pull together in the same direction?
I mean, I think it really is just kind of talking to people on a very personal level and just bringing them together and figuring out what we have in common. I think that that's so important. I think, you know, Interfaith Alliance, we have a lot of members who are people of different faiths, but we also have a lot of members who are people who don't follow any faith at all. And I think that common humanity, that appeal to it, and kind of the funny things, I think it's good to have some jokes or to have some, you know, discussions where it's a little bit of levity in there that's really good. I'm struck just by a thing prior to my being Interfaith Alliance. Anne and I were in Pakistan at a time when there was conflict between the U.S. and Iran. And we were walking downtown, and there were a huge demonstration of Pakistanis that saying, we will support our brothers in Iran, and if America attacks Iran, we will attack them with our F-16s. And Anne and I were kind of very quietly trying to get by this crowd, and this one guy comes up to us and looks at us and says, you're American, aren't you? And we were kind of like, ah. And he said, don't worry, this is just about the governments. We love Americans. And it was just this kind of moment that really broke the hard part of this moment of seeing a big, huge crowd that we thought was anti-American and they were not. So I think that going through the personal stuff is very important to do.
It's great. Jay, was there ever a time when you thought to yourself, I just got to get out of here?
Well, maybe more recently when I just kind of thought about, like, you know, I think when your job as other duties is assigned and you kind of work through those things, there comes a point in your life where you go like, okay, the other duties that are assigned need a greater intellect than I have. And I need to get out of this and we need to get some younger people in who understand that either the technology or, you know, whatever and can kind of work on these things. So I think, you know, there is that sense of passing the torch on to the next generation of people. And we've got some terrific new people on our staff that are going to be just great. And I look forward to being involved as a supporter and just hearing what's going on and being an activist as I leave.
And I know also that your very devoted wife had a large role to play in persuading you that now that she is retired, you could go out and play together and have a good time.
Anna retired in May, and she's been having entirely too much fun, and that kind of inspired me. She's gotten involved in doing some Afghan refugee resettlement, which is great. And so we're looking for different opportunities to get involved. I'm on the board of a group called Lunch and Learn in Tacoma Park, and we put together programs in the summer for school kids, so they're both learning about things and getting lunches so they don't lose out on a summer of education. And I'm also I've been the long-term chair. It kind of sometimes feels like a lifetime commitment of the Tacoma Park Recreation and Community Engagement Committee. So that's also just a fun group of people.
So you're about to become a supporter instead of an employee, a staff member of Interfaith Alliance. Make the case to all the other supporters out there about why you will continue to support and they should continue to support Interfaith Alliance.
Sure, sure. Well, it's obviously an organization that I worked at, not just for the paycheck, but for the commitment to...
I can affirm that. It was definitely not just for the paycheck.
But the commitment to the work that we do, and it's tremendously important. And I think anybody who reads the paper or sees what's been going on since, you know, the last few years knows that we need to continue to work on these issues. And it's not stuff that's going away. It's a lifelong commitment and hopefully an intergenerational commitment, and people get their kids involved. I know both my sons have given to the organization. My brother's given to the organization. My sister has. So it's stuff that you need to talk to friends and family about continuing our important work.
I will say to you that you've done an excellent job of giving people who are listening an insight into one of the reasons it has been such a delight to work with you, both as a volunteer, as I was when you first came aboard, and as a professional, as I have been for the past 7 years. There is no one I would rather see at the beginning of the day, other than my wife, who can lift my spirits and give me a sense that what we're doing is going to succeed. Jay Keller has just begun his well-earned retirement after almost 15 years at Interfaith Alliance, where he held the title of Director of Outreach and Operations. Jay, to say we'll miss you, I'll miss you, is a ridiculous understatement. But I'm glad that we could do this today, and I could publicly say thank you for everything you've brought to the organization, to the causes we fight for, and to me personally. Godspeed, my friend.
Thank you, Jack, and thanks to all the listeners and supporters of Interfaith Alliance.
That's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. www.theintersection.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, go team. I'm Jack Moline, and that's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.